This is a public service announcement from Anatomy of a Movie, reminding you to always be yourself unless you can be Batman. That's right. We're here to talk about Lego Batman, the movie. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Anatomy of a Movie. We have a full panel today, excited to talk about Lego Batman, the movie. Lego Batman movie. It's got a long title. I just call it the Lego Batman. We have Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans.
We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a newcomer, an intern from the shadows, been plucked and put onto the panel.
Here I am.
Amelia Fabiano.
Like a Lego piece.
That's right.
Plunged right
stuck
in.
Here.
This is her very first show ever.
My debut. Thank you so much.
As we always do, well, first and foremost, we assume that you've seen the movie, but don't worry. There's not much to spoil, I guess, although maybe there is, depending on how you
Batman's Bruce Wayne.
Wait.
What?
There you go. But as always, let's start with overall impressions. Let's start with you, Amelia, because this is your first one.
Okay.
Kick us off.
All right. Well, I absolutely love this movie. I mean, I am no superhero connoisseur by any means, but I feel like you didn't need to get all those references that were dropped in this movie. I thought it was phenomenal. It's a great movie.
Nice and concise.
Yeah.
Marissa.
Yeah, you know what? I watched the first Lego movie for the first time at the theater when that came out, and I was like very apprehensive about it. But as I kept watching it over and over again a few times, and then people, you know, loved it, and it kind of became a cult hit, but it was a big surprise for a lot of people, and I found myself fairly
call
surprised.
It a hit.
Yeah, it was a hit.
It was a hit.
It was a hit.
It was a bona fide hit.
I personally enjoyed the first one, so I was like really expecting to enjoy this one, and like I enjoyed the DC world. This was funny. There were so many references that I laughed at. And it was fun, energy through and through, and I really enjoyed this one as well.
Dimitri?
Yeah, I mean, holy bat-tacular. you know, this, thus far, it's, you know, the most fun I've had at the movies in 2017. I know there's a lot more of 2017 to go, but considering two movies already this year have made me angry, and we're already in February, for me to really say that I had a great time, that means a lot. This movie just made me laugh. And the Batman throwbacks are crazy fun. And just for kicks, they throw in Doctor Who. I mean, that was awesome for me. Everything is awesome in this Lego movie follow-up. I think Batman is the perfect superhero to really poke fun at. And Chris Nolan, Tim Burton, Adam West, Burt Ward, and okay, I'll even throw in Joel Schumacher. They all had to have had a good chuckle at this Lego Batman movie if they went and see it, and they should. I know I did. Now, go get me a can of that bat shark repellent and a rope ladder, and I'll be good.
For me, I love this movie. I was very excited to see this movie. I don't go to many advanced screenings just because of time. This was one that I was like, all right, I'm doing this. I loved all the references. I'm glad. You know, I'm very well versed in the Harry Potters of the world, the Batmans of the world, and I've seen all the Batmans, so it made it very in depth for me. However, if there's one caveat, it didn't quite have the same not twist, but the same creativity as the first Lego Batman movie, and that was the only portion of it for me that was missing. And there were moments for me that were just a little bit too long, which were for the kids, because I noticed that the kids were laughing. So I could forgive it in that respect, but if it was strictly a movie for me, I would have cut certain things. But yeah, I understand.
But I want to go back to something that you said, Marissa, you said at the top. I think the Lego movie, you know, I don't want to speak for everybody, but it took me by surprise. Because I think the first thing that might go through a movie audience's head when they see advertisement for a movie called The Lego Movie is that this is going to be a 90-minute commercial for Legos. It's going to be a cash grab. Okay? So when you go and see it, and the kids really love it, and there's a difference, too. There's a difference between kids' movies and animated movies that there's a fine line. Sometimes they're just for kids, okay? Where only the kids are going to love this movie.
Minions.
And the, yeah, Minions, like, you know, the Smurfs movie, whatever. There are movies that the parents have to take the kids to that the kids are only going to love, and the parents are going to be like, get me the hell out of here. For Lego Movie, that could have been true. But when it's an actually funny movie and it's good and that the adults can watch it, like a good Pixar movie or some of the DreamWorks movies that cater to the young and old, that's when a movie clicks. And I think the Lego Movie, that's where it surprised everybody. It wasn't go buy Legos after you see this movie. You had, it had, thematically, it was a lot of fun. It had great comedy. And I think... Go ahead.
Sorry, it had a good balance of, you know, directing its audience for the demographics.
Like, absolutely.
Kids enjoyed it. Adults enjoyed it. Females enjoyed it. Men enjoyed it. Like, it covered the gambit of how many people, like, really liked it for the nostalgia factor, for the practical factor of it. And I think Lego, like, that movie did a great job establishing the universe and what we can expect out of, you know, the comedy, the humor, the timing of everything. And I think this one did a good job of, like, knowing now that, that that's the universe, we can also expect it in the second one.
Well, let me ask you guys this point, just to kick things off. Why didn't we see a kid playing with Legos in this one? Just to give it that sort of consistency. The fact that there's other characters, you know, like Voldemort, you imagine a kid sort of being the puppeteer of this world, and therefore this is the reason, and it makes sense, but we never saw that.
I think it might be because there were so many references that go, that are definitely catered towards the adults. Like, a 10-year-old kid playing with Legos now is, are probably, good chances, not going to know all the Batman references from the 60s and the 50s, however long Batman's been around. So, and then there are just other villains and references in this film that, granted, if you take it from a kid, good chance that they're not going to know all these characters that was smushed into this movie that really catered to the adults who are watching this right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take it as... I think because the world has already been established. Mm-hmm. You know, in Batman, Batman is in the original Lego movie. And we're just taking him in his own movie, his Lego movie here. And I think because the world was already established as to builders, you know, what builders can do. And it's pretty well established that Batman, as a Lego character, is also a builder and what he can do. We don't need to see that kids are doing this. I think that the Lego universe, this is an expansion of the universe. We've already had the setup. Now we're in the Lego universe even more. And even Chris McKay says for the next Lego movie, the Ninjago movie, and the next Lego, you know, Lego Movie 2, there's going to be more expansion of this universe that, that people are going to latch onto. So it's just about building, and it's doing the right thing for a sequel. And we don't need to see kids playing with it because we already know that there are master builders who can develop this world. And I think they did. I think they did a great job in doing that because it's not a sequel. It's just,
it's a companion.
Well, that's
it's like Cloverfield. It's like 10 Cloverfield Lane. It's not a sequel.
It's a parallel companion.
But we're in the same world.
Well, that's why. Like, because it's not a sequel 100%. That's why it would have. Just a nice reminder of that. But Amelia, what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely don't think it was necessary to see kids and or for kids to even see kids. I think it's one of those movies where it's, I almost like that better. It leaves it more up to the kids' imagination to see, you know, themselves playing, interacting with this world.
It was just me. That's fair enough. Take. What I loved about it was it's the same people back for this movie. Right, and Seth Graham Smith, he wrote it. We've talked about him before.
Absolutely.
Emerson alum, by the way.
Yep.
As well, I mean, soon to be an Emerson alum.
Yes.
But, you know, we talked Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and how much that was fun, and Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer, and so this is just a different version of it in more kid-friendly, with Legos type of story. So I enjoyed that everyone sort of returned for this and had that same... The love that you guys are speaking of for the Lego movie, it translates and it continues with this one.
Absolutely, because I think, too, the humor is on point. Yes. It's it's a humor that is somewhat lost in today's cinema. And even Chris McKay has said some of his favorite movies were movies like Airplane. Okay, that's zany slapstick comedy. They don't make zany slapstick comedy, but they can. They're getting away with it in the Lego movies, and particularly this one, because it has that. To be slapstick, you can't just be physical. It's got to be verbal.
It's,
you know, surely you can't be serious. I'm very serious. Just don't call me Shirley. Stuff like that, and that's all in this Lego Batman movie, where they're. It's almost like the Marx Brothers, or even to an extent. Abbott and Costello. Yeah. So it's a kind of humor that isn't latent in today's live action, but they're getting away with doing it in animated form. And that's what I love. Like I found myself laughing my ass off at this movie.
I was surprised at that, funny. Honestly.
Yeah.
It wasn't too absurd either. It wasn't too, like, okay, out there.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Well, what I appreciate about it most, and hopefully, Amelia, you as the film theorist, because you're closest to college, so I'm sure they've crammed this crap into you. The idea that you can take a character that we've known for so many years and basically just reconstruct it in a way we've never seen him. And the fact that he's a loner, not by choice necessarily, right? Because that's what we've always seen him as. Unless you count the 1960s Batman, in which he was just an upright citizen, then it's because he is, for lack of a better term, a douchebag.
Well,
yeah, true.
Yeah, he is a douchebag, but it even in the DC universe in the comic books, he is a douchebag. Like, he is a loner. He doesn't. There's very few people that he'll ever let in, and he keeps tabs on all of his Justice League mates. I mean, literally keeps tabs on them. He knows every single one of their weaknesses, just on the possibility they may go rogue. He's got to know everything about them. He's also a great detective. But he is, in a sense, a douchebag, because he says, there are times he goes, I don't need you, Clark. Mm-hmm. Like, I can do this. I can beat you, like, at your own game. And that's the thing about Batman. What I really liked about this movie is it is a movie that actually approached it in a fresh way of him being the loner. I love that he's watching Jerry Maguire by himself. And that's one of those absurd scenes where, oh, you complete me. And he starts laughing, going, you fool. You don't need anybody to complete. I don't need anybody to complete me. It's the realization of that loneliness. But thematically, from a Batman history standpoint, the Batman Returns sequel by Tim Burton, okay, it's a perfect example of this and him wanting to connect with Selina Kyle, played by Michelle Pfeiffer. There's a great scene in that movie where they show up to a party and they're the only ones wearing masks and they're the ones that gravitate towards one another. That really goes to showcase Batman's, like, in a sense, his standoffishness, his loneliness. Alfred's always saying, you should try to go out. Mm-hmm. The Chris Nolan Dark Knight, he was truly, he set off on himself. Like, purposely, he said, I'm going to take the hit for this in the Dark Knight. He goes, let me take the hit for this. Harvey Dent,
he's the good guy.
He's the good guy. Let me take the hit. And that's the way Batman is. To turn it on its heels and bring it to light that he could use a little bit of help. Like, that's what makes this movie fun, and it's so easy to poke fun at.
Well, even so, just the whole interjection of, wow, if this has been going on this long, Batman actually sucks at his job. That, to me, was the freshest idea of it all, and you're right, you're like, well, yeah, maybe he does suck at his job.
I like that mental twist, though, because we really don't see it that way. We always think Batman is the protagonist, but and then that we actually enjoy having a villain, but we'd never really see the negative side. It's like, oh, maybe you're not doing your job. And I like how they twisted that on him. Like, yeah, you are a douchebag.
Wait, what?
You're allowing all this to happen.
I don't like what you're saying.
Incompetence.
But again, Batman doesn't kill. Neither does Superman, too. So that's why all these villains, in one way, shape, or form, they keep on escaping Arkham Asylum, and so Batman has to get on the case and do whatever. But you're right, it was a nice little... Again, if you're going to make fun of a DC character, Batman's the best one. I think because he's very layered as a character. Superman's easy. Yeah, he's a Boy Scout, right? But Batman, being that he is so dark, and in this movie, just to have him watching Jerry Maguire and eating popcorn in his... He's sitting in his home theater that's huge, and he's by himself, and he's laughing at You Complete Me. That's hysterical. You had me at hello. You know, Phil Arnett was again, his voice. Will Arnett, his voice talent in this was, fantastic.
They said from the get-go that Will is the only one that can sort of match that dark tone without having to modulate him.
And the bravado.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does seem to, whether it's BoJack Horseman or Joe from Arrested Development, he has that sort of self-importance that's like his natural acting default.
Right.
But so as we're talking about the jokes, I do want to ask you guys, how do you sort of draw the line? Chris McKay has sort of talked about the joke process for them, but the fact that, like, they were willing to go there, the fact that they made fun of Iron Man, who's similar, rich... and, you know, creates the super, you know, Iron Man sucks, that then becomes the password. They make fun of Suicide Squad, all these things. They're not afraid to go there.
Yeah.
Which takes a lot of, frankly, balls.
Mm-hmm. But that's the root of great comedy. Chris McKay is also quoted as saying that part of his theory, his philosophy in going into this, and it was something that I had heard of actually before. I'm a huge fan of the television series that was on forever called Mystery Science Theater 3000. Okay. Joel Hodgson and the crew, great. And if you've ever watched the show, it's a bunch of people watching a movie, and they're making fun of the movie as it goes. It's a B-movie. And they're throwing other movie references in there. And McKay quotes creator Joel Hodgson as saying, we're throwing 10,000 references into one two-hour show. We understand that maybe only one person is going to get a reference and the joke's going to go over everybody else's head. He goes, but if we make that one person fall off his chair laughing, job's done. And like this movie, when the Daleks show up in this movie, I'm like, the fuck? The Doctor Who? The Daleks? Like, who? Like, Five people, the kids aren't going to know what a Dalek says. Exterminate. I was like, who does that? And what does that have to do with the DC universe? Absolutely nothing. But it's brilliant, and it's comedy for a person who's a Doctor Who fan. So, you know, I love that atmosphere. It's the same thing with the Zucker Brothers. Throw everything up against the wall. Some of it's going to stick. Mm-hmm. And that he uses it to it's a great effect.
And I think it's just like it's the demographic as well. And like the type of people who enjoy Marvel movies, they're probably going to laugh when Marvel characters make jabs at DC characters. And it goes back and forth. It's a two-way street. And I think that also adds with, you know, the Daleks and Doctor Who. I never, you know, watched Doctor Who. So, like, I didn't get that reference, but I still thought it was funny. And I think it's just the same mentality that everyone has. If you like sci-fi comedy, whatever, you're going to laugh at other sci-fi comedy. And I think it's just, it goes back and forth.
The other thing that I was surprised that Chris McKay cited as a lack of a better word, like an inspiration, he cited his desire to cross the stream, so to speak, and he's going as far back. He cites The Last Action Hero. Mm-hmm. Okay, this was at the time probably Arnold Schwarzenegger's first flop. It was a very big budgeted movie. I know Shane Black contributed as far as writing goes, but if you folks aren't familiar, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger played a movie character that this kid loved, like this movie action hero, and he somehow got a magic ticket in which he was able to dive into the action movie that his hero was in, and so it crossed streams, and so he took that and he's like, that's what I sort of kind of wanted. He goes, I wanted more of that. He goes, I wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger to face off against King Kong. Like, why not if you're going that far? He goes, I never saw it in that movie, so I'm able to do it in my movie. He goes, I'm able to just have Batman go up against King Kong and Godzilla and stuff. But I think that's what makes this movie, it makes it palatable because then it becomes not just all Batman references. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then it becomes everybody knows who King Kong is and Godzilla. And you might not know the Daleks, but you know who the Gremlins are. Mm-hmm. When I saw the Gremlins in this movie, hysterical. I started cracking up. Yeah. I go, Stripe!
Like, I think it was Voldemort for me.
What did you think in terms of the jokes? Like, you know, going too far or having the brevity to just go for it?
No, I think, I mean, they definitely, if you're going to put it all out there, like you said, you got to put it all out there. Yeah. Some of them are going to stick, some of them aren't, but it's not like, all of them were funny. There were none of them that were like, oh, okay. It was, even the ones that were less funny are like, okay, that was all right. And then the next one would just really get you. Nothing was poorly executed, well, I don't think.
There's a sort of Taoist mentality of like, having the ability to make fun of yourself is one of the ultimate powers. Mm-hmm. And I bring that up because having Voldemort in the movie, J.K. Rowling, they had to get rights to it. And she said, yeah, by all means. But then she started writing spells that Voldemort could do.
Yeah, which is awesome.
So I appreciate, J.K. having that sort of sense of humor to be like, okay, yeah, I'm in. Let me help you write this.
Yeah,
and that's also Warner Brothers property as well. So, I mean, that's already a shoo-in. But I'm glad that she has that self-awareness. I mean, she's rich. She's richer than God. So she can do that.
But it's not damning. That's the other thing, too. Nothing in this movie was damning to said character. Right. Like, it doesn't...
Their character would do.
It's the characters might do. Yeah. We're seeing them in Lego. It's not disrespecting the characters. There's no ill will towards King Kong or Voldemort or the Daleks. It's just really funny. Now, what I find even funnier is, he had a bunch of other villains that he wanted to throw into the movies. Mm-hmm. And this killed me. He wanted to have Kathy Bates from Misery.
Which is
hysterical. He wanted to have Moriarty at one point. He even pitched Daniel Day-Lewis's Bill the Butcher from Gangs of New York. I mean, he wanted to have David Carradine from Kill Bill. I mean, that's going for it. I just think I love that thought process. Yeah. And even if you're a Mel Brooks fan, again, without people like Mel Brooks, who really brought satire to light with Blazing Saddles, High Anxieties, making poking fun at things. That's how you get the Zucker Brothers. That's how you get Airplane. That's how you get Naked Gun, right? And these are slapstick comedy that you have to watch and listen to in order to appreciate what's going on. This movie, you're willingly paying attention because the jokes can come so fast. They're not expecting you to get everything. Mm-hmm. But what you're going to get is going to really make you laugh out loud.
Yeah. You're going to get at least one joke.
At least. Hopefully more.
Well, here's the, I know we're spending a lot of time on the humor side of it, but the real trick of it to me, and I think that something that's underappreciated is, in order to pull something off like that, you have to be a master at storytelling. Mm-hmm. Because the real root of it for me is what it's always been, the strength of Batman and the Joker. Done in a completely different way, and basically a rom-com.
Yeah.
That's the structure
of
the movie, and then everything else builds on top of that. But if you don't get that right, and you don't have a mastery of rom-coms, then all of this that we're talking about falls apart.
Yeah, and they're doing it in a brilliant way, because there are comics, I believe in the Chris Nolan Dark Knight, like the Joker's like, you need me.
Well, the little line says, I complete you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in a sense, yes, that's what the whole thing of an arch nemesis is. But Joker's a classic example of that.
Right, but I like, going off of your point, Phil, I like the twist on the conventional rom-com. Right. It's more of a bromance. And, not in, like, in a gay way, not that being gay is bad, but, like, they paired these two together. It's like, they have to be together
I hate you too.
See, exactly. It works, because I think it's funny, because it was more built up as a fun bromance. You're like, yeah, that makes sense.
Well,
yeah.
It's hysterical too that the Joker gets all depressed when he says, I don't need you. He goes, what do you mean?
Yeah.
You
he's need like, me? Oh, no, I don't.
I don't need you. I mean, it's
bromance.
Again, it's throwing that stuff of, it's throwing that stuff up in the wall, seeing what sticks. And even the stuff that doesn't stick, you're going to throw it in there anyways but you've already surrounded it by witty humor that, again, this is where it transcends. Kids are going to laugh at a ton of stuff. They're going to appreciate the visuals, which, by the way, as we'll talk about the visuals, mm-hmm. this movie was great to look at. Yeah. Let's be honest. Yeah, yeah. It was great to look at, right? From a color standpoint, it was great to look at. Kids are going to get some of the jokes. Adults might get probably a little bit more, but you never know. The kids are going to get something that mom and dad aren't watching on TV or stuff like that. The audience I saw it with, the kids were cracking up like from beginning to end.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest part is to go back and say which jokes are your favorite, because, you know, inevitably, as you're like holding on to one joke that you're like, oh my God, that was so funny, you're going to lose it within a matter of a minute because mm-hmm. the next one's coming, right. which says a lot about the movie.
Yeah, it needs to be quick like that, though, I think. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. So,
let's see. Let's talk about the relationship between Batman and Robin, because it was again something that's very different. We've never seen it in the sense that he accidentally adopts him,
right?
Yeah,
and has no interest whatsoever in raising him except for the fact that he's small and he needs him.
I like the way that they established it, because again, it was unconventional in how we know of the DC, you know, Batman canon. The fact that like he was kind of forced to be with Robin and already like didn't think the greatest of him, already cut him short, mm-hmm. And that the fact that after this mission he's like, oh no, Robin's actually pretty cool, I can use him. I liked that, and that built a more genuine relationship between Batman and Robin.
Yeah, I mean, it's again going off that, number one, I didn't realize it was Dick Grayson until he said his name, because they were using Frank Miller's from the Dark Knight Returns Robin, which was the first female Robin,
Carrie,
yeah. and had the goggles and everything, and even to an extent the blonde hair ish. Mm-hmm. So, number one, Michael Cera's best role since Superbad. Okay, he was great. His voice talent in this movie was hysterical. Yeah, and it sort of turns the heels on the relationship that Batman has with Dick Grayson, because it was always contentious, and I loved how they even brought in Nightwing. Again, as a Batman fan, like, Dick Grayson's biggest gripe with Batman was that he wouldn't let him in. He's like, dude, you gotta let me spread my wings a little bit, and he's like, no. Not gonna happen, you're always gonna listen to me. And so that's Dick Grayson that was like, big deal. He leaves Gotham to go to Bloodhaven, which is in this movie, and he becomes Nightwing. And then he even comes back when Batman was supposedly dead, and he picks up the mantle of Batman for a little bit. But their relationship that Dick Grayson and Bruce Wayne have totally goes back to that, I'm a loner, you're going to listen to me, that's it. It's like, I rule. This isn't your typical award. It's not what we saw in the 60s show either.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
But with the same references.
Absolutely.
And there are so many ways they could have tied Robin in, and the fact that he's his adopted child that he doesn't find in his bat cave for a week. I think it's genius. It's hilarious. Very well executed.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just love the notion that he thought he had two dads.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm not gonna tell him.
His padre.
And in a weird way, what I love about this, right, it is that dual commentary of they're commenting on sort of the DC universe, but at the same time sort of setting it up, because we are getting a Justice League movie. And so even though we haven't seen it yet, to get the flip side of that, and that everyone just hates Batman. Mm-hmm. And this is where having so many different characters works for it, because it's like, here's all the people that half of them I've never even heard of, but the fact that they got invited to this, they must really hate Batman.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was like, they were also like, it wasn't just the Justice League. They were referencing the Super Friends from the 70s. I mean, we saw Zan and Jaina, for crying out loud, like the Wonder Twins. And it was just like to see Sid and Jaina get invited. But again, if you're a Batman fan, it makes sense. Batman is a dick. And like, he is, like, literally, he has tabs on all these people. He has files on them. And he's like, I have to be prepared. And so the mere fact that he shows up and they're like, what are you doing here? He goes, oh, you're having a party? Yeah, of course you were invited. That was a great scene. And then he goes off on his own again. Yeah. He can't even be part of something that's fun.
Well, he couldn't join in. And I just the whole notion that he's like, I have to excuse myself. Bye. And that's it. That's his way of doing it. He his social interaction is so messed up. It had a good core of, you know, as I said, that rom-com, but then that family aspect.
Right.
And they played really nicely into recreating that family portrait, which was the sentiment of it all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. And you guys want to talk about Barbara?
Yes. Sure.
Barbara Gordon. I don't know. I'm not familiar with Barbara Gordon that much, to be honest. She's not in any...
Sure she is. She Barbara Gordon, daughter of Chief Commissioner.
Well, I know who she is, but the movie versions, I've not seen her that much.
She's only been in... could have been the... She ends up being Batgirl.
Yes.
And then she ends up being...
But not in the Batman and Robin version, right?
She is Barbara Gordon. Yeah.
In the Batman...
You're talking about the 60s?
No, I'm talking about Batman and Robin.
She ends up being the niece to Alfred dopey. So I'm not even sure if they even
went... She's a very obscure character.
Yeah. Barbara Gordon, even since the 60s, was always part of the Batman canon. And then she went off to do Birds of Prey. Mm-hmm. But she became paralyzed by the Joker. So she's always been there. The Chris Nolan, he really wanted to focus on Batman. We only, in the last movie, did we get the hint that Robin, who was the walk guy,
Joseph Gordon-Levitt,
could potentially be Robin going forward if Chris Nolan were to do it, but he wanted to make Batman singular. So they tried to do it in the Joel Schumacher. Tim Burton avoided it, having like Barbara Gordon and even Dick Grayson in it. And again, it just goes back to the singularity of the character. But Barbara Gordon through the comics and even the 60s show, that's why it was great, because when Barbara Gordon takes off her thing, she's got the purple suit that Yvonne Craig wore in the 60s show. I only wish that she drove a motorcycle. It would have been awesome.
Well, it was funny because she's like, I'm going to call you Batgirl. Well, I'm going to call you Batboy.
No. Rosario Dawson.
Rosario Dawson. I love her. She's great.
She was great. Got the joke.
Let me see, since you kind of... I haven't seen it. I don't know much about it. But the platonic, non-platonic relationship between Barbara Gordon and Batman. And from what I understand, is it the Batman the Killing Joke, the latest movie or whatever it is? Have you seen that?
Yeah, it's an animated... That's an animated... based off of the comic. They took a lot of liberties. And that's what people are complaining about.
In particular, the Barbara, like, you know where I'm going with this?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does anybody else know?
I haven't watched The Killing Joke, so no.
Okay.
I
won't. Well, apparently there's a scene between Barbara Gordon and Batman. It's somewhat graphic. I don't know. Have you seen it directly? I have not.
Yeah, I have seen it directly. The movie is, it's rated R. It's a rated R animated movie, and there's stuff in there that's not, yeah, it just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And it's what a lot of people sort of kind of complained about, because it's not in the comic. It's not in the graphic novel at all. Why they decided to put it in this, I have no idea.
And can we call it a sex scene?
Sex scene, sure.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I haven't seen it directly, it's
implied very much so. Uh-huh. Okay. And that's the thing, too. Again, Batman being Batman, he knows who Batgirl is. Like, he knows. It's not even a question. Batman's relationships are, like, from what I can recall, I don't ever recall there being one with Barbara Gordon that I can remember. It's always been Selina Kyle, Kim Basinger's character in Batman, the Tim Burton one. I forget her name right now. they've been like female reporters. They could be ballerinas, but it was and to a point like the troika. We got Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. At one point, even Wonder Woman would be a thing mm-hmm. other than Superman, Wonder Woman. But you know, I don't ever recall someone with much more comic knowledge than me could maybe bring up if there was ever a relationship between Barbara and Bats.
Well, the thing that I like, because I'm not really familiar with Barbara Gordon character either, but what I liked how they portrayed her, because it, you know, is the voice is Rosario Dawson, and the fact that she's ethnically ambiguous in real life, like, that kind of translated to the character yeah. in the movie. And the creators, you know, Chris McKay, they thought about that because they took the general demographics of what would be Arkham and Gotham. It was like, good chances she could be someone who's not Caucasian, and I like how that translated to this character. And, yeah. and it wasn't, like, really, you know, hit it on the head with a nail, like, she's not Caucasian, you know? It was just another character that it was new to us, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and going back to what you said at the beginning about how, you know, this movie translated well to men and women, I think she was such a vital part of that, and just, you know, having her be as capable as Batman and having her, you know, kind of be the... You know, counteracting him was I love that.
Also. I think it's a natural male-female relationship. Guys are just so bullheaded.
Yeah.
I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. I know it's you know very
speak for
binary.
Yourself.
I know it's a very binary way of looking at it, but.
But I'm you know I'm kind of glad that it was Barbara Gordon and not Catwoman because we've had so many versions and iterations of Catwoman now that like the fact that we shine a little bit more light on Barbara as a foil to Bruce Wayne, Batman, is kind of nice to have a different female, not really antagonist, but just a companion to him.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Who doesn't have to rely, that's the other thing too, if we're going to dig a little bit deeper, we always talk about female characters, and one of their measurements of how strong that character is do they need to be constantly saved? I mean, to have a female character saved once in a movie something, but they have to be self-reliant, self-resilient. And the way that they portrayed Barbara Gordon in here is that she was self-reliant. She was self-resilient. She could, you know, she was trying to get, like, I know I can need help, but I know I can handle my own. It's you have to realize that you need help.
Yeah, she was the one that critiqued Batman in the beginning, which was important.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, if you want to get into a more adult theme in the Lego Batman movie, there you have it.
Also great for kids to see, too, I think.
I think
this,
I agree.
This really strong female character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Agreed, agreed.
Should we talk about the gadgets? Another great staple of any Batman movie. We got it all in this one. We got the helicopters, the motorcycles, the planes, the cars, everything.
I did enjoy that one moment, and I'm talking about the self-awareness humor when he's going through the security the security system, and they're like, please, you know, give away all, like, whatever you're armed with, and it's like just a pile of all of his weapons that everyone could enjoy. I thought that was pretty funny.
I liked how they... It appeared as if they had every iteration of Batman transportation, whether it be the Bat boat, the Bat copter, the Bat plane, the Batmobiles. Yet at the same time, let's go back to the, you know, one of the classic things about the 60s show is Batman and Robin hopping into the Batmobile, going, atomic batteries to power, turbines to speed, and then the Batmobile launches itself out of the Batcave. When they were doing it in this movie, I'm like, that is so great that they're doing it here. But it even looked like they had a Joel Schumacher Batmobile, and those are the most cartoonish in the live-action movies. But, yeah, if you followed any of even the old Kane Finger comic books and his Batcopter the way it was, even the Batcopter in the 60s they had, and he had the Batboat. Yeah, the gadgets, it was just a ton of fun. Okay. But the reference to the shark repellent, was great.
That was.
You know, I mean, that is a classic scene in the 60s Batman movie.
But it's not a real shark in the movie. That's what you have to realize.
But it was great. It's a great scene. That's why I say shark repellent and boat ladder.
But, like, even that one weapon had a joke. They set it up. They're like, this is completely useless. And then it actually had a purpose at the end. So, like, I liked how it came full circle just for one weapon.
Yeah.
Shall we transition into the more the visuals of everything? Because I know the movie like this is bound to be more technical than story-based, mm-hmm. unless there's mm-hmm. anything that you guys story-wise want to touch on.
I think thematically, I think it hits from a male-female perspective. When you're talking about the visual style of this movie, the one thing that I noticed, and again, I saw this in a premium large format. I did see it in an XD. It was beautiful to look at between the colors. Nothing was ever really hidden. Whether I was in the Phantom Zone or whether I'm back on Earth doing the big fight scenes, Chris McKay, I like what he says, we're still trying to make it feel like the brick film and like the old Rankin-Bass stuff. Rankin-Bass being, those are the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Christmas specials that we grew up. And I thought about it, and I was like, yeah, it sort of kind of does have that. There's a tangibility-ness of it, but the way the characters move is like they mm-hmm. have to be...
They're not bendable.
Based in... Right. Exactly.
They can't go into 3D space.
Right.
They can't break that Z space.
Yeah.
Which I enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what I enjoyed about this, and this goes both to the visuals as well as, I guess the story ultimately, because they're playing with tropes and whatever, they're able to move at such a lightning pace, and the amount of set pieces that we're able to see is fantastic, and they use it. They use action in the right way, but then there's moments of, I don't know if levity is the right word, but, he's heating up the lobster. And just the way that's lit, and he's standing there, and it's going around and around, and just the fact that we can appreciate that for the amount of seconds that we do, they use both techniques extremely well for jokes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I appreciated how they used, I guess, as many Lego pieces as they possibly could for even things that very well could be graphics, like the fire in any of the fight scenes. If you look quickly, you think it's animated, but then you look closely and it's actually one of the Lego fire pieces.
The cool thing about this particular film, they actually have a digital library of every type of Lego brick that has ever been created and by the actual company, and they use that as elements for this movie. And the cool thing is, and I also read that they, another film that reminds me of it, but this film they built in the animation form off of volumetrics, which when we covered Pixels,
right,
that movie with Adam Sandler, a lot of the graphics were done from volumetric
totally.
Styles. And when I was watching this, it reminded me of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't notice the volumetrics. And the blocks built upon other blocks to create that Z space that Legos can't in real life.
Right. And, the other great thing about, too, that Lego has done throughout the years, even before there were movies, there were Lego video games. There was a Harry Potter game. Mm-hmm. There is a Batman. I think there were a couple of Batman Legos.
Have you ever played the Legos?
Oh my God, they're great.
They're fun.
Yeah, it's awesome.
They're really great.
I'm not a gamer, but they're fun.
They are a lot of fun. But what's the interesting thing, the transition from video game to big screen is, what makes the Lego video games fun and has their charm is that the characters really don't speak. Because we know that their painted eyes and faces on the little brick thing, they would just make sounds. They'd go, like if somebody broke up somebody breaks, they broke in pieces and their pieces would bounce down the stairs.
Yeah.
And they would just make little sounds, almost like R2. Like Lego Star Wars is hysterical. They're not talking. Once you bring it up to the big screen, like in the Lego movie, in this movie, they had to talk, and I think they found the perfect voice talent to do it, and I don't question, so even if I go back to play a video game, I like the fact that they don't talk, because that's part of the charm, and that's where the comedy comes out. Here, you gotta up the ante, because you're not playing this video game, and I think it's a perfect transition. So when they do another Lego Batman Lego game, video game, they don't have to go back, they don't have to get Will Arnett, they could just go back to their tried and true formula, because it always works. And like the movies thus far, the video games had always gotten really good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So. And the cool thing that you mentioned, because, like, the video games don't really speak, but obviously this movie, all the characters do. And it's hard with the facial expressions when they don't break the third, you know, Z space there. But what was interesting for all these characters, the mini Legos, that they actually had to put decals on them, and they used that as a template to render with the actual animation to get the faces.
Yeah.
So for every facial expression that originally started off an actual tiny decal that they put on Lego size, and then they rendered over that with animation to get the mouth movement,
that's
the facial
awesome.
Expression.
Crazy.
So that is a labor of love in and of itself.
I know the patience it must take to do something like this is crazy. And the fact that they didn't even finish animating it until January, late December, I think that's what I read.
Yeah, well, they were supposed to have a little more time.
Yeah.
The movie was supposed to come out in May. And, you know, Chris McKay was like, yeah, he goes, we were supposed to have 3 or 4 more months. He goes, I wanted a couple of things in there, and we had to clean up a few things. And, you know, it would have been interesting, but I think I get it. He would want some more time. That would have been fantastic. I think the release date that they had filled a vacuum, because there really hasn't been, like, a really solid kids movie out there. And Warner Brothers knew what they had. I mean, I'm sure that they were watching this movie come along. So they knew that they had a fun movie that would probably do well. And this is the perfect, you know, when you think about what's out there. We have action movies out there. We have a psychological suspense thriller horror movie that's
definitely
doing well.
Definitely for the kids.
Yeah. We've got 50 Shades Darker. What's it called?
Also 50 Shades Darker.
50 Shades Darker, okay. Yes. That's out there. There's nothing really. Yeah. Oh, and we're also getting into Long Weekend. I know at least in New England, for people who were brought up there, February Vacation's coming for some aspects of the country. So it's a great time to release a popular good kids movie, you know. So I sort of applaud, because if they released in May.
Yeah, I think it would have been too much. And then the last one came up in February as well.
Yeah.
Not that you have to stick to that, but.
No, but I think part of the reason they released it in February is because I don't think at that time they knew exactly what they had. Like, Warner Brothers knows that they have a good movie, but they may not know whether the audience believes it's a good movie. And then it's so you release it in a time period where, we're not sure that
it's...
Yeah. There's not much cover. We don't think it's a summer... We don't know if it's a summer movie yet. Because you'll notice that happens a lot sometimes with movies, is that they release it in a slow period, and then once it becomes... Hunger Games, I think, is a good example, which I believe first came out... The first one came out, I believe, in March.
It came out in March.
And then the subsequent ones came out during a very popular holiday time period. Because they didn't really know what we were going to get. Sometimes I just say, if that's when you release the first one, you'll have success... And people really liked it. Just try to release it around that same time, too. So.
I think it's also good timing, especially for this film, because at this point last year, it was all Batman versus Superman. And that came out in, like, March of 2016. So it's around the same year, or, like, the same time of the year, just 1 year later.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good pump out, you know, a one-year turnaround.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it fits right in there, as I said, between Justice League, we're getting Wonder Woman, we just had Suicide Squad, although not just, but, you know, that's coming out on demand now and stuff. So I think it was the right time. And furthermore, like, I appreciate the fact that they actually, you know, because we talked about X-Men Apocalypse, you know, it got a couple months switched and didn't have that time. Imagine, so I'm glad that they, like, to have this product that, you know, they worked amazingly fast.
Mm-hmm.
They really did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and they started shortly after a Lego movie. I mean, more time needs to be put in for an animated movie just because of all the detail, like you were saying,
right,
to put in that detail. And they started shortly thereafter. And I forget what happened to the other director. He went off...
Oh, Phil Lord and Phil. They stayed on as executive producers, but I mean, they're so in demand.
They're doing like a live action.
It's Chris Miller and Phil Lord.
They're busy in the live action aspect. But the great thing about this film is that the script was already pretty much set already 3 years ago. So they essentially had 3 years to work on this film after Lego Batman, because. Like 3 years ago, they already had treatments for this film. So I think they had more just production time to work on it.
Yeah.
and rather than rewrites over and over again, you know.
Yeah. Compared to what DC and what Warner Brothers has for their live action superhero stuff, this is their best superhero movie that they've come out since Chris Nolan exited the Dark Knight series. Since then.
They need to make everything Lego now.
they should.
I want to see everything in Lego.
Yeah, I'd make Aquaman Lego.
Going back to Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Yeah, they're doing something huge.
The Han Solo movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're directing that.
Yeah.
Kind of somewhat big.
Legit could projects, be. You know.
Pretty big property.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And they're both only 41, by the way.
God bless them.
Good for them.
That's definitely insane. And, yeah, you know, I mean, just their history alone. We've talked about our love for Jump Street.
Sure.
They were part of that.
They're the good writers.
So definitely a lot there already for them.
Yeah, and also, if we're still talking about the VFX and production also, the great thing that they learned from Lego movie, usually when the sequels you can already build on, like, okay, what can make us go faster so we can pump out another one. They used a program called Frankenglips, which is pretty much a program that helped them render faster all their effects. I'm not going to get too technical with you, but it helped them render with all the shapes and the lightings faster in real time compared to the Legos.
Right. Mm-hmm. I would love to still compare, because remember there was that big article that came out with Toy Story 3 that it took them 7 hours to render one frame, and I would love to know pound for pound what it compares to now. Like, how much faster are we? But at the same time, we throw in so much into the animation that it still probably takes the same amount. Just because we're going so much deeper with it.
We sort of talked about a little bit about that when we did Zootopia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we talked about them rendering every single leaf on every single tree. You know, now, what has happened, as it always happens in the movie business, is that you see where we come from Toy Story. You see where Pixar has come from Toy Story, from the first one. Toy Story was just game-changing. And when you look at trailers for the new Cars 3 that'll be coming out, they've come leaps and bounds. We're adapting and changing and making and creating new technologies, because as where the original Toy Story, its charm relies in its story. And when it first hit theaters, it was groundbreaking. We had never seen anything like that before, okay? Much like, too, Beauty and the Beast, the animated, right? Mm-hmm. When Disney was coming back into doing animated. So then every other movie, though, they want to make it look better than the previous movie. So when you have it, but that's just the way the industry is, whether you're live action or whether you're animated. You're trying to utilize technology to make your movie look better. Mm-hmm. James Cameron, is a perfect example of that as well. Create new technologies. Let's show something that we've never done before. Let's push the envelope. And then once that movie comes out, somebody else is going to glom onto the technology that he created and put it into their own movie. And so it's always upping the ante. The industry is always striving, I believe, especially when these types of movies. You can't compete if your movie looks like a VHS animated, computer animated movie, but it ain't going to compete in this. Not in today's world of animation. People will suss it out as it being cheap, and they won't go. And there have been a couple of animated movies within the past, let's say, year, that have looked cheap, and they're DOA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have to stay current. The people who do Coraline and Kubo, Laika, they're another company that always pushes the envelope. They never rest on their laurels, and they always make their movies look fresh, new, exciting, and bigger, and cleaner and nicer. It's the same thing with video games. We want more detail.
Well, here's the interesting part. We're watching technology from 2 years ago on screen. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, it's not the latest technology. It's technology from 2 years ago.
But even that technology
that's what,
changes.
Like,
but
that's yeah. what advanced that's, in this film when they used the Franken-glimpse. That was literally a hybrid solution from the two programs that they used on Lego. This program allowed, like, put those two programs together to make the rendering time twice as fast.
And part of it is because we as an audience, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. We want more detail. You know, we want more. If you're playing, you're not playing Pong as a video game. I mean, you're doing it out of nostalgia. The same thing, well, you know, you're not playing regular Mario Brothers. You do it because of nostalgia, but you want more today. Today, and it's all about, I want more detail in my animated movies. How much, you know, we're going to make this look beautiful. We're going to render this. So that's why when you get movies like Zootopia, like, it's a gorgeous movie,
yeah.
you know, to watch. Moana, too, you know, song-wise aside, but it was a beautifully rendered movie. Same thing with Frozen. Say what you will. But when you look at Frozen, compare it to Princess and the Frog, which, again, a beautifully drawn movie, like, audiences are becoming more discerning as to how they're going to spend their money, and they don't want it to look too big.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like the fact that you brought up Zootopia because I believe it was that movie that also used more advanced technology from Big Hero 6.
Right.
With the lighting and stuff. And because they had so many different animals with so many different leaves and forests, let alone the animal fur, they had to speed up their rendering time, and they used a more advanced program that they used from Big Hero 6.
Yeah, and think about what we're doing here.
But
we're
that was because people wanted detail.
We want more detail.
So how do we do it faster if people want more detail?
Yeah, I find it funny that we're looking at animated. We want animation to look more like real life. Well, then why is it animated? I mean, it's sort of like the Catch-22. I mean, but I can still watch a movie like Snow White or the original Cinderella or Dumbo. Granted, I'm talking about a lot of these Disneys, but these are the ones that were in the theaters. They're beautifully drawn, even to today's standards. When you see what Disney did with The Little Mermaid, that was their movie that actually brought them back into the animation scene. It's still a beautifully rendered, drawn movie. There is something to be said, and that's what John Lasseter set out to do when he became their head of animation. It's like, I want to be able to hybrid. I want to do hand-drawn. I want to use computer graphics. With Batman and the Lego movies, we're not talking about having to put in fur, you know?
Right.
It's part of the joke that they're sort of blocky. And let's pay attention to that.
They're supposed to be.
Yeah, we don't want them to break that wall, so to speak. We don't want him, like, walking like a human. Or, you know, we want even the cape to be sort of stiff. So, you know.
Anything to add, Amelia?
Yeah, no. I mean, when you're looking at Frozen or Moana or something, you know, there's something to be left up to the imagination with the animation. But with Legos, you know, you're working with something that's a real-life figure, and you have to make that as beautiful as possible and as realistic as possible to a certain degree. And, you know, what would this look like if this was actually happening in real life, which is the movie. So,
Absolutely.
Yeah. Animalogic did a great job, though, because they also worked on the first Lego movie, and they came back for this one.
Everybody's coming back.
Yep.
Let's see. It's always tough to talk about editing in terms of a movie like this. Although, they have three editors, which is always interesting to me, because at the end of the day, how does it, like, fully work? You know what I mean? That's... because I really... Personally, I want to be lucky enough to edit an animated movie just to see what the process fully looks like. Because, you know, even in all the editing classes that I have taken, no one's really explained that process to me of how it works. I know at the end of the day it has to be put together, but I imagine that the job is much different than it is to edit a live-action movie with takes and cuts. And
blah, blah, blah. Right. Yeah. I really like the pacing of this film. And yes, it is a fairly shorter film, but not once did it lose my attention. And I think it's also because there were so many graphics. There was not, it never was boring. You know, there was just so many things to look at, joke after joke after joke. The pacing and energy was, like, consistent throughout this film.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for me, I forget what the length of the runtime is. It might have been able, they might have been able to make it.
An hour 44 minutes.
No, an hour and 4 minutes. Marissa and her numbers.
I don't know. Copy and paste.
So 1 hour? No, it had to be
104 minutes.
104 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, well, it was like an hour and 4 minutes. Nah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and going back to your point about editing.
Yeah, but that's an hour and 44 minutes. Thank you.
Is it? Yes. Okay. I suck at math. That's why I was a communications major.
I suck at math, but that's an hour and 44 minutes. Thank you.
So,
I'm surprised.
I guess when you're doing an animated movie, even for the hand-drawn, you're already, in a sense, number one, you don't have to fully render. You don't have to fully render your shot. You can use stick figures. Okay, do I want this shot to be from over the shoulder? How am I going to blend in? Like, what do I want to compose? Like, what? How do I want this? How do we pre-visualize this? How do we draw this? You know, you can do it as storyboards, and you're already figuring, like, the editing process, to me... And I could be completely wrong. If there's an animation editor out there, please write into the show. Because to me, it would just seem a logical step that it's already built into when you're animating. Like, unlike a movie where you're shooting things and you're like going, well, you know what? I want this take and put it in there. The only thing that you can do is, like, you can edit and change the takes of the dialogue.
Yeah.
The scene itself isn't going to change. But the way Arnett delivers a line can change. Because it's animated. The mouth's just moving anyways. Yeah. I'm not looking for syncing issues here. So the sound editing to me becomes a little bit more important. Because for editing, I got to figure that they're already, in a sense, they already know the shots and the sequences and what they're going to want. And then it's all on top of how are we going to layer in the music? How are we going to layer in the sound to the Batmobile? Do all that stuff.
So well, you can also, so, you know, to that point, you get to see if jokes are working or not. You know, you can start to see it. And what I appreciated about this movie is that for the entirety of the runtime that we're talking about, it takes advantage of everything. Down to all these credits we always see at the beginning with the logos of every company, and it takes about a minute most times, and it's like, okay, let's just get this out of the way. But here we take advantage of that and like, oh, cool logos. Yeah, don't you like the logos? Yeah, they're cool,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Look, it's Warner Bros.
All important movies start with black.
Yeah. Self-awareness.
I don't know who these Rat Pack people are, but they have a cool logo. Like, yeah, I mean, that stuff was, again, self-aware, but it was funny.
Yeah.
The other thing that you always notice about animated movies, and this, to me, because my patience, if I'm hearing voices and I can't put a face to the voice, so I wait for the credits, but the voices are some of the last people that come up in the credits. You always have to wait. Like, in a regular movie, the cast is one of, you know who's in the movie within the first 10 minutes, usually.
Because the credits are actually on screen to know.
Right. On an animated movie, most of those credits come at the very end, and if you're seeing who the voice talent is, you gotta wait for the producers, the writers, the animators, and then, oh yeah, these are the people that voiced them. So, Zach Galifianakis. He was great.
Joker.
He was awesome.
He was awesome. He
was great. Indeed. Indeed. Anything to add about that?
About Zach? Or
Well, I guess you could add a lot about Zach. I mean, he plays the Joker.
Well, I like the fact, you're doing the research that we know, because we've covered a lot of films here that deal with, animation and voice actors, that a lot of times the voice actors are recorded by themselves in a booth. But for most of this film, the actors were together with each other paired. So they had, real-time joking back and forth, and a lot of it was improvised.
Yeah.
And, if you have Michael Cera and, Will Arnett and Zach Galifianakis, all these comedians together in a room, Lord knows how many jokes were actually recorded and dropped. So I can't imagine. And I liked it because you definitely got that real-time back and forth banter.
I think more movies should sort of aim for that. And I know it's easier to do it. You can schedule, more people that way, because then you're not depending on, what's your schedule and your schedule. I'm just depending on your schedule individually and versus hers. But yeah, you're right, Marissa. It does come off on screen as much more organic and, yeah, and fluid.
Absolutely. What were some of your favorite scenes in this movie?
This is the hardest task ever. Favorite scenes. Yeah, my favorite scene was... it was Batman early on, you know, because... Like, for example, when he's following the Joker and he doesn't really know what the Joker's really doing. And it's so much that he feels something's off, but he's playing directly into the hands of the Joker. Right. That, to me, was a lot of fun. And then I guess the characters at the end. It's just a, you know, it's a hodgepodge of throw in anything.
Right.
We have I love Sauron.
Sauron
the Eye. Because, yes, you know, he's just all... But, like, you know, in this context, we can finally make fun of it. It's a stupid eye.
Yeah.
That actually has a purpose.
Yeah.
And can do stuff. So. I agree. There's so many moments that it's really hard to pinpoint one. But I did love the whole concept of the Phantom Zone. That they actually used that is part of the DC universe. And I liked how they used it in a comedic way. Like, all the bad villains are here from all different stories. And, like, this is the place, this is essentially their hell slash, you know, purgatory. They're all stuck here. And they used that. Like, the fact that they can go in and go out, and they're like, let's get everybody back in.
But was I the only one who was looking for Zod?
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, I thought Zod? I thought Zod was going to be coming back. Now, Zod is a throwback to the Superman movie with Christopher Reeve. Yeah. You know, I have to go through one of my, to me, one of the funniest parts, talk about self-aware, is when they're dinging on Batman's age and his incarnations, but I love when Alfred's like, sir, I've seen you go through similar phases in 2016, 2012, 2008, and then they're cutting to in Lego form. Scenes from the movie. So we've got 2012, 28, 2005, 1997, 1995, and 1992, and 1989, and that weird one in 1966. Yeah. And that's the one that they actually used live footage, and he's doing the Bat Tussie. I was, like, just cracking up at that. It was so self-aware, but so wacky and smart.
Well, I love his run. Yeah, I've aged really well, huh?
Yeah.
What was your favorite moment?
I think I gotta go with when they first started characterizing him, when he goes back to his Batcave alone, throws the lobster thermidor in the microwave.
What the hell is a lobster thermidor?
I didn't even know you could microwave that, but
you can't.
I don't even know what that is.
There is lobster thermidor, yeah. That there is such a thing, and I just love how he's
sitting on his boat alone. I think. That's probably my favorite.
I did love it, and I have to call myself out. I feel like I am a big fan of romance comedies, you know, rom-coms, a big fan of them. And the fact that when they were making fun of all their romance, especially Serendipity, which is actually one of my favorite movies, and, like, I laughed so hard at that joke. Even though, like, I love that film, and the fact that they're laughing at it made me laugh.
Yeah, it was hysterical. I mean, some of the quotes. Robin, my name is Richard Grayson. The other kids call me Dick. I was like, really?
He's like, kids are awful these days.
Oh, they can be.
It's hard.
Yeah, why did you build this thing with only one seat? Because last time I checked, I only had one butt. I mean, again, that's just going back to... let's just be silly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even, like, the climactic scene at the end where, like, the town is literally splitting in two, and then they're like, let's band together and put it back together. And then the way it just literally finishes, it clicks back together in such the Lego form. It was never out of character. I loved it.
And, you know, this is more of a sound effect thing, but I just like the shooting aspect of it where they just pew, 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 pew. Like, that's how a kid would do it.
Pew, pew, pew.
You know, just that all aspects awesome of it, you know, all these things are marrying into one to create this final piece, if you will.
Best friends at the beginning.
Although the one thing that didn't happen in this movie that happened in the, they didn't have quite the song like, Everything Is Awesome. I was a little disappointed. I was expecting another song of that nature in here, but we didn't get it.
Yeah. They tried.
Yeah. I did like the Batman song, though. Yeah. I thought it wasn't too corny. I thought it was funny.
It was very, like, Shaft, you know, inspired for that.
I liked how they brought in Man in the Mirror. That's great.
Right. Love oh.
The children's choir. Yep. The orphanage choir.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't bother me that I didn't walk out humming a tune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was happier that they referenced the na 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 na. That, again, growing up on that, mm-hmm. like, it didn't forget that. No. I love that. I love that. And how that the Neil Hefti composition was in, you know, in the heavy metal Batman. You know, that was good stuff. And again, everything is awesome. I think that movie was almost predicated as like that, like a musical-ish kind of thing. This one isn't. Didn't bother me that they didn't come up with a jingly song for me to remember. I just remember that the music was fun to listen to, especially the opening sequence against, you know.
Which the plane is called a MacGuffin.
The plane is called a MacGuffin. That was awesome.
That was great. I think, you know, like, not to jump ahead, but like the promotions for this film also kind of played off of the Black and Yellow song. So, I mean, we had a lot of, like, references to already original songs, and mm-hmm. I think if you're going into this film expecting another original song, like Everything is Awesome, yeah, you're not going to get it. Right. But it had that, you know, the musical odes to the original songs that everybody loved.
Yeah, there are so many cultural references in the movie. I think it's important to match that with the music, sure. too. So
let's talk about the promotion aspect of it, because it, you know, a very smart campaign, as I even open up, you know, always be yourself, except when you can be Batman.
That's a t-shirt. That's a t-shirt slogan that's been around for a while. Like that saying, I think that's hysterical.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, and I think they've had 4 trailers overall, which is, to, you know, I mean, typically what, you only, at most, you really do 3.
Mm-hmm. So you do a teaser, mm-hmm. if you have the opportunity to do a teaser, which is usually about a minute, mm-hmm. and then you could do 2
official trailers,
which could run up to 2.5 minutes each. So, yeah. And then there's layered in with today, there's specific trailers that are online only, your television spots. Yeah, so this one, I just caught the trailers and whatever was on Tv.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
there was a lot of marketing behind
also, it. There was another film that we covered. I'm trying to remember exactly which one. I'm not sure if it was Storks or another animated film fairly recently where they did a short film by WAG that was pretty much a setup for Ninjago.
Okay.
It was the Master Chicken. Or the, you know, the master ninjas.
Right.
We had that chicken and the master ninja, whatever, fighting against each other in Lego form. So even that was pretty much a promotion for Lego. And that was just a few months ago.
I saw the trailer for Lego Ninjago when I saw this movie.
Yeah, the trailer for so that was on the.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, you didn't see that trailer? Did you see that trailer?
No, I didn't.
It'd be interesting. That one to me is the movie, the Lego movie that one to me is their risk, mm-hmm. because, you know, the Lego movie that's just being based right on Legos. This one has Batman as a cachet. This one,
fan following.
You know, Ninjago. I'm like,
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I'm like wondering. I mean, their marketing is going to have to be smart because they're going to have to really bring in the kids and they'll have to do the Lego thing. But this one to me is the movie that's going to. This would be the big test. Like, how big can Ninjago open up to, and will kids get it? Because I didn't even know what the heck it was, other than it looks like a ninja warrior.
But yeah, that's exactly what it is. Like, forgive me, I can't remember what movie I saw because we cover so many movies here. But that
no, we don't.
4 to 5 minute short film was pretty much the setup for Ninjago. So if you saw that short film, you'd understand what the concept is of Ninjago.
Right.
It's a bunch of ninjas fighting each other in Lego form.
We'll find out. Well, if it makes fun of like Bruce Lee type movies and things of that nature, then it could be good. I don't know. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to sort of the reception of it all. Obviously, very good. Number one in the box office. And Dimitri and I talked about this last show. We talked about it with John Wick Chapter 2. This was a good weekend for box office. A lot of movies did brought in a lot of money. And obviously this did too. And it's just good to see, like, usually, as we talked about, February is a dumping ground for movies. Very high score on Rotten Tomatoes, very high score as well in terms of cinema score, an A-minus in cinema score.
Right.
So people are loving this movie. I think it deserves a little bit higher, even, to be honest. But
I think A-minus for me is perfect. But, yeah, we talk about the opening weekend, which, you know, is number one in just a little over 4,000 theaters. And it does $53 million. And now we're going into a long weekend. Mm-hmm. We're going into the President's Day weekend. So you're going to have that extra Monday bump. Kids are out of school. If the weather in Los Angeles is going to stay the way that it is, going to the movies would be a good thing. As of, you know, its domestic total as of February 16th, $64 million plus dollars. Foreign, it's done $37 million thus far. For its foreign take, you know, we're looking at a production budget, you know, I'm seeing is $80 million. That's a lot of money.
Yeah,
it is. that's
it's a lot of Lego almost, sets.
Yeah, that's almost double what John Wick was, and that's a live action movie with, you know, Keanu Reeves. $80 million, like, that's the other thing. There was a time when people thought, oh, animation. It's a cheaper way to go. Again, with technology, you don't want it to look cheap. You can't have it look cheap.
Sausage Party, well, I guess, you know, to sidebar real fast, Sausage Party, they specifically made it look a little bit cheaper, right? And that's part of the fun of it, if you will.
Sure, but
it didn't work great for me, but...
Yeah, and the grosses to that. I mean, I'm not saying that people didn't go to that movie because of the way that it looked, but when today's animated movies, you know, again, Pixar and Disney set this bar. And if you're coming, so that's what people are expecting when they go to these animated movies. So if you're a Warner Brothers, if you're a Fox, DreamWorks Animation, you have to at least come up, at least try to come up to the bar. You might not raise the bar. Like, I wouldn't say that Despicable Me is better than any, from an animation standpoint. It's not better than a Pixar movie, but at least it's up there. Like, you're not going to say that it looks cheap. This movie did not look cheap. No. You know, again, it looked
like $80 million.
Yeah. It looked like $80 million, filled the entire screen beautifully with all its use of color. And black and yellow and reds, and it was great. It was a great movie to look at. So, yeah. Did anybody see this movie in 3D?
I did not. No. I didn't need to.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need to.
I saw it in XD, but it wasn't in XD 3D. But I was happy to see it in XD. Seeing it on the large screen was really good, and the sound mix was really good on this as well. Absolutely. So I thought it worked great. 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. Right now, it's one of the highest reviewed movies that are in the top five. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty spectacular.
Absolutely,
you know, it's huge. It looks like they're gonna have a really good hold for their second weekend.
Yeah,
you know, just because of word of mouth, and there's really nothing out there for that market to take away from them. You know, you have a rated R comedy. Is Fist Fight rated R? I forget.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah. And, you know, well, Great Wall is now coming PG-13, out this weekend. PG-13,
but, you know, you don't have anything for, say, the kids. So, yeah. they're gonna have a tremendous hold. Mm-hmm. Meaning that their second weekend, their drop.
Yeah, they got till March before Beating the Beast.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that I see coming anyway.
And that's later in March, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
March 10th? Mm-hmm.
Is it that soon? I thought it was later. Yeah. I thought it was around the middle. But they've got, yeah, until they have real competition for themselves, like, they can more or less run the table. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, bully for them.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have a $100 million plus dollar grossing movie soon enough.
Yeah.
Soon enough. And it'll up their sales in Lego. And it'll up their sales in Batman. Yeah.
And we know that
Legos are expensive.
They're really expensive.
Yeah. I thought I could get them for like $20. See, Jesus.
That big Millennium Falcon's like $150. And it's Jesus. Lego. And you got to put it together yourself. If I'm spending that much money, you put it together for me. Because I can't do that crap.
I'll put it together, but just give it to me for $20. Jesus. Really, I remember, like, you know, and that's all you get. I remember just buckets of, that's it.
Yeah, but...
Where's the buckets?
But I remember growing up, there were never licensed Legos. Mm-hmm. There were always just the blocks and that's the generic...
And you use and your imagination.
They had the, like, the generic gas station, airports, fire, police. Flowers. Yeah, it was all, like, just generic characters. It wasn't until... I don't know if it's been over 10 years now that they started licensing out and getting DC, getting Marvel, getting Warner Brothers, getting Harry Potter. You know, but they also do NASA, they do haunted houses, they do Disney. Now it's all about the license and how expensive that they got to pay for that license for. But if you run into a family whose kids love Star Wars and putting together Lego Star Wars, that shit is expensive. Like, even for, like, the small one, your $25 goes for, like, a, you know, three Legos to snap together. Here you go. He's got his little land speeder.
Yeah. But I think that's what the first Lego movie did well, because they used a lot of those licensed Legos. You had freaking Gandalf in there first. When you had Lord of the Rings, you know. And, of course, you had Harry Potter in this one, you know, with Voldemort. So I think the first one really touched upon the different types of licensed Legos more than this one, obviously.
And, you know, to an extent, what this sort of kind of reminds me of, when you talk about the licensing, having to get J.K. Rowling's permission. I don't know, you know, if they had to get permission to use King Kong or Godzilla. I'm not sure about that.
Actually.
But the last time that I remember where licensing was such a big deal in a movie was Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Because they were mixing Warner Brother cartoons with Disney cartoons, and they had to get all of the licensing. Not only did they have to get the licensing for the characters, but could I have Daffy Duck play opposite Donald Duck? So what were you going to say? You found something regarding?
Yeah, the whole Gremlins and Agent Smith. Warner Brothers bought
I forgot about Agent Smith, too.
Agent Smith, that was great. But Warner Brothers bought the MGM library, so that's how we got the Wicked Witch as well. And, you know, we talked about Kathy Bates or Moriarty. But, yeah, they also had license to MGM characters, and that's why we had a lot of different villains.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh, here's a question. There's a question. Phil and I were talking about this before. Okay, so the shark that was a villainous shark. Okay, now my initial knee-jerk reaction was, oh, that's the shark from Jaws. But being that we're in today's world, is that a Sharknado shark?
No. Here's what. Well, because I actually looked it up, and they've made reference that it could be, but they've stated that it's the Jaws from the shark from Jaws.
Did they call him Bruce?
Is it Bruce?
Yeah, Bruce.
Okay. Oh. And they did do the lines, like, we're going to need a bigger... It's not the bigger boat, but, like, he did make a line that...
I missed that
clearly
one.
...clearly referenced
flying
Jaws.
All over my head.
Yeah, okay. Like, it was like, we're going to need a bigger tower or ship or something like that. Yeah. So. Definitely Jaws.
All righty. Any final thoughts before we wrap up a Lego Batman movie? Starting with Amelia. You open this up, why don't you?
Yeah. Well, I love the snake clowns at the end.
Snake clowns!
I think also one of my favorite parts. I don't think there's anything scarier than a snake clown, so that's where I'm going to leave it.
There you go.
I'm glad it came around.
Well, now you put it in my head, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Marissa.
You know, I enjoyed this movie just as much as the first one. And, you know, we always say sequels usually tend to not do as great as the first one. I think this is just equally as good.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was equally as fun, and where this one may not have hit certain peaks that the first movie did, I think this one had things that the first movie didn't have in it. So, Lego my ego and watch my Lego movies. Everything continues to be awesome for Lego right now. And, I just say push on, continued success, and, you know, keep on being as creative and as funny, and this won't burn out. It won't tire quickly, so long as you keep it interesting and fun and witty and intelligent for the adults. Then they can have a good shelf life.
Absolutely. I agree. And my final thought is I enjoyed this movie. Still, Lego Movie is a little bit higher up for me than this one, but nonetheless, this one was a ton of fun. And if anyone has just the generic Legos, I'm willing to buy them. No, because here's the thing. I like the idea that I can put my own, like, if I want to make the Death Star, I can make it myself. I don't want the pre-built, you know?
I'll tell you what, the next time I go to Disney, there's a huge Lego store in downtown Disney. I will look for just generic Legos for you.
You know?
And you'll get my Disney Pass discount. Is that fair enough?
There you go. We got a deal.
I'll see you at Disney, folks.
Thank you guys for joining us. Let us know your thoughts on the movie. Did you like it? What was your favorite jokes? Which references did you absolutely love? How many times you've seen it? So on and so forth. At DMovies 1701.
Please support me. Get me over 9.
At Serafini TV.
That's right.
I don't actually know your Twitter.
It's just at Amelia Fabiano.
There you go. Yeah. Spelled how it sounds.
And after this show, she's probably got like 100, and I'm still at. Oh. I just dropped to 8. They went over to you, I heard.
I'll make it 9.
And to Marissa.
Thank you, guys. And of course, at the Popcorn Talk, check us out for more movies. If you made reference to Beauty and the Beast, we've got that coming up. The Great Wall next week, Fist Fight as well. And we've done over 320 shows in our library, so definitely check out those. I don't believe we covered the Lego Movie originally.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, we did. See,
yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, we did.
There you go. Check out that one, too.
And the Harry Potter's as well.
So, all right. Thank you guys for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff. We would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.